Welcome to the Leaf by Lantern podcast, a show for Christian artists who want to retell fairy tales in the light of scripture. We'll discuss how to approach retelling a fairy tale according to the truth and beauty of the Bible, from ethical issues to images like rose gardens and dragon hordes. I'm your host, Alicia Pollard. Hi, everyone. I am very excited for this episode. This one is special because I'm revisiting a fairy tale that I already discussed this season, Hans Christian Andersen's literary fairy tale, The Snow Queen. If you haven't listened to my previous conversation with Kimberly Ireton, in that episode, we talked about Kimberly's theological reading of the tale, and we looked into the images of the rooftop garden, the roses, and snowflakes, and that was fascinating. I'm returning to the same fairy tale with a different guest, KB Hoyle, or Karen, to talk about Karen's retelling of the fairy tale that just released this month, Son of Bitter Glass. Note that Son of Bitter Glass is the second of Karen's fairy tale series. The first book, Son of the Deep, was a Little Mermaid retelling, and Son of Bitter Glass picks up the story in the same world with a few of the same characters. Because the first episode of this season already included a reading of the original fairy tale, I encourage you to just go back to listen to that one, or just find the fairy tale online. But before we begin, here is Karen's bio. Karen is the CEO, acquisitions editor, and creative director of Owl's Nest Publishers. She is also one of their teen and middle grade authors. Her love of good stories began when she stepped through a wardrobe at age 6, and she never looked back. She is the multiple award-winning young adult author of The Gateway Chronicles and The Breeder Cycle. In addition to her many novels, she is also a longtime columnist at Christ in Pop Culture, a sought-after voice in the areas of storytelling and culture, and she has contributed articles and essays to a variety of publications. KB stays busy at her home in Wisconsin on a winding creek with her husband, their 4 sons, and the foxes, deer, woodpeckers, cardinals, grass snakes, hawks, and toads that frequent their land. Be sure to check out Owl's Nest Publishers to see some of her other books, including Orion and the Starborn, which I absolutely loved, Son of the Deep, as I mentioned, and The Queen of Ebenezer. Here's our conversation about her latest book, Son of Bitter Glass. Hi, Karen. Welcome to Leaf by Lantern.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here today.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. And I'm excited to talk about this retelling, especially as it's a little different because Son of Bitter Glass is the sequel to a previous fairy tale retelling. So I think that that's interesting how that shaped the story a little bit. You really built out a kind of Hans Christian Andersen inspired fantasy world here. So I wanted to start there. A lot of interesting world building that you can do when you put those stories together. So can you tell me about your choice of the Snow Queen? Why retell this fairy tale? Why retell it second in the series? What drew you to it?
So I came upon the Snow Queen. Well, like many people, I was kind of inspired by the movie Frozen. You know, a little bit funny because when you sit down to read the Snow Queen after having watched the movie Frozen, you discover that it has virtually no similarities to the Disney version of the story, more so than many of their other fairy tales. So, you know, if you watch The Little Mermaid and then you read The Little Mermaid, you can say, oh, I see what they did here. They, you know, they made it happier and things like that. But the Snow Queen has almost no similarities to what they did in the Disney movie. Sorry, after I wrote Son of the Deep, I sat down and I needed to find a fairy tale to match up to Isbrand's story. So Prince Isbrand is a character in Son of the Deep, and I knew that his story was going to be next. And I was looking for a fairy tale to match up to him. And again, kind of inspired by Frozen and whatnot, I was looking through Hans Christian Andersen's stories, and I found The Snow Queen, and I thought, wow, this is a great story. It has depth. It has spiritual symbolism. It was long. You know, as fairy tales go, it's actually pretty long. And
yeah, it's like a novella.
It's like a novella, practically, yeah. And, you know, it has also, I look for stories when I'm looking for stories to retell in my fairy tale collection, as there's going to be many stories in this collection, I look for stories that have strong characters that are both male and female, as this is a romance series where both characters have things to do in the story. You know, they both have agency. And I loved too that the Snow Queen has this sort of Bildungsroman already built into it. So you have this story of a boy who is stolen away by this Snow Queen character and his friend. And it was a natural friendship story as well. You know, his friend, who in the original tale is named Gerda, and she sets out on this journey to go and find and rescue him. And I thought, you know, not only is this a great story, but it will play well with a modern readership as, you know, as well, without me having to kind of shoehorn any of that in, if that makes sense. You know, as it existed, it was already a good story that would play well today. And so, you know, she sets off to rescue him and encounters all of these wonderful, magical, mysterious things along the way. And she grows up as she goes. And then the wonderful things that happen, it's really an interior and exterior story as well. The spiritual growth that both in the original story, it's Gerda and Little Kay that both of them go through, and how the things that they experience on the outside, you know, everything from the Snow Queen, who is the, you know, the witch character, to these challenges that they meet along the way, are really just kind of reflections of their personal growth and how they are essentially grown up by the time they reconnect at the end. And I thought there was a lot to play with there and a lot to expand. And that's what I look forward to, is the expansion of their characters by the end, and what I could do with that as a novelist. And it matched really well with the character that I planned to tell the story, you know, Isrin's character from Son of the Deep. So there was just no question in my mind that it was the right story to tell.
No, I love how that felt seamless. Like, even I finished Son of the Deep and I was like, wait a minute, because not to spoil it, but you put in a pretty big clue towards the end of what's going on with Isbrand. I think, am I saying that right? Isbrand?
Yeah.
I can't pronounce anything. I read more than I talk. So which is fun on a podcast. But yeah, there was a pretty big clue in there. It's like, oh my goodness, there's a completely different narrative going on with him that's separate from the Son of the Deep stories.
Yeah, I try to, for close readers in Son of the Deep, every time you encounter Isbrand in the story, in Son of Bitter Glass, he has a nickname, he's called Issa, but you know, his name is Isbrand. I try to, in Son of the Deep, every time you encounter him, I try to put context clues as to what is going on with him. So, you know, he's always kind of just described as being cold. There's something in his eye. You know, things like that are going on. He's got a pain in his chest and things like that. So I'm giving away all the secrets, but you know, some readers have a hard time picking up on things like that. Other, you know, for those of you who did pick up on them, if you're like, was that intentional? Yes, it was intentional. And similarly, when you read Son of Bitter Glass, you should be looking for things that hint towards the next book as well.
Yes, I know. I have a couple of guesses, but again, it's funny to talk about like a book that's just been published because you don't want to spoil it. But
right.
A fairy tale retelling is a little harder to spoil than another type of book, because you know, the things like the happy ending and some of the big images that are going on are known. I think that's the fun of it. It's like you're not completely surprising the reader. It's kind of like I've compared it to before, to going to a Shakespeare play. Pretty much everyone knows what's going to happen. With Romeo and Juliet, they're curious as to how you do it.
Right.
And that just gives you a lot more freedom. So,
right. It's like, what's my spin on this? And as I like to tell people too, for my fairy tale retellings, I'm never going to do like a twisted story. There's not going to be, that's not my jam. I'm not going to do this whole misunderstood villain. It's not going to be from the villain's perspective. You're not going to have the heroes suddenly turn into mass murderers or anything like that. It's always going to be an expansion of what the sort of original intent of the fairy tale was. As much as we can identify what the original intent was, because I'm also acknowledging that these fairy tales have been around for a long time. And sometimes, you know, and sometimes we can't identify what was the original culture that the story came from, because they are so timeless in ways, in many ways. You know, like, for example, what was the original Cinderella story? You know, where did it come from? You know, there's no way to say, oh, from there, there's the original story, you know, because there are, you know, I can think in my mind at least three that we could say were original, and they're from all over the globe. But I will always kind of choose one. So that's why I said for, you know, The Little Mermaid, it's like, well, I'm going to Hans Christian Andersen, which I think anybody would say Hans Christian Andersen is kind of, you know, the OG Little Mermaid. However, you would also say of The Little Mermaid that it has echoes of Cupid and Psyche, you know, which predates Hans Christian Andersen. And many people say that Cupid and Psyche is the original fairy tale, like the original one, that you could find echoes of that in basically any fairy tale. And so you to trace all of these back, you know, to really unravel the threads and say, you know, where did they come from? That's an interesting discussion to have all on its own. So, but when you read my fairy tales, I'm not going to be doing anything where I'm trying to totally reinvent them and toss out what I would consider to be, you know, the good, the true, the beautiful that you find within these stories. Now, I'm not shying away either from things that are hard or difficult or even dark when we encounter them, but it's always going to serve whatever I considered to be the original spiritual symbolism or intent of the original story.
I love that. And it makes me trust you as an author, because the story is a very powerful thing. You can hurt someone really badly by telling a story that does not represent the world. Well, like the bitter glass that warps someone's view of the world or creates a picture of reality. Yeah. Which is not true. So that's part of the focus of this podcast, Leaf by Lantern, which someone else helped me come up with that title. I'm really bad at naming things, but the idea that scripture is the light we see by, and that scripture is the perfect illumination for what Tolkien called the tree of tales.
Yeah.
So if there's something in a fairy tale that's true, beautiful, and good, scripture will help us understand what that is, and also interpret complicated things. Like when a supposedly good character does something bad. That's been a really fun study to do. So the Snow Queen as a witch character stands for evil. We don't have to – I loved Frozen. I think the sisterhood aspect that they completely invented is really fun. But it takes away that sense of like there's true evil in the world.
It does. And, you know, I loved Frozen too. When it came out, I thought they told a really good story. They just didn't tell the story of the Snow Queen.
No, they just took some of the images. And some of them, as I was going over it, like, you know, the frozen heart and stuff, it's like, okay, I can see where that came from.
But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely not really a retelling, more of like a kind of inspired and then ran with it.
Yeah.
But yes. So you're retelling, looking at the fairy tale, looking at your story, did some really interesting things with the images. So I wanted to ask you about a couple of those. So roses are really important in the original fairy tale.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing because there already was a rose, the character Rose in Son of the Deep.
Yeah.
You decided to use a different flower to be a symbol of faithful love. Can you tell me about the pronouncing things, camellias?
The camellias.
Camellias, thank you.
I'm not laughing at you. It's, you know, again.
It's okay if you are.
Having lived in Alabama for 14 years, camellias are very, very prominent down there. So it's the only reason I know how to pronounce it. So yes, exactly. So now flower symbolism is very important actually throughout the original story, which I loved. And because I love flower symbolism. Actually, I love symbolism, period. I flower symbolism, color symbolism, you know, all the sort of weird medieval symbolism, animal symbolism, all of it. I love it. I stuff it as much of it as I can into my books. But the flowers in particular. So when I read the original fairy tale, I noticed, yes, how prominent roses were, but I couldn't redo the roses thing because roses are an important motif, symbol, and character name, and the character name is important for symbolic reasons in Son of the Deep. as well. So I thought, okay, we can't redo this. So I started to look into other flowers that might be a good symbol for the sort of relationship and tie between Isbrand and Ira, instead of bitter glass. And I landed on camellias because a red camellia is symbolic of, it means my heart bleeds for you.
Oh.
And so I thought, well, that really works. And it, you know, for all the things, and again, I'm not going to give spoilers for what happens in the book, but just, it just really worked. And so red camellia is a sort of through line in the story. It represents a lot of the early chapters in the first half of the book. They take place inside this garden that's special to Ira and Isbrand. Well, I mean, it's special, but it's also, it's this sort of cage that is a place that Isbrand has to stay. And but the camellias are particularly special, especially the red camellias. And then that's a motif that remains. And so yeah, red camellia means my heart bleeds for you. And there are other flowers throughout the story that are mentioned and that come up. A few of them, I don't try to, you know, overstuff it, but that have particular meanings. So anybody who's nerdy about that sort of stuff, like I am, if you, you know, do some Googling, you'll kind of understand what I was saying about various things. And some of it I overtly say, like I mentioned snowdrops in the story, and they, you know, Ira and Isbrand do talk about that. And there are, there's more than one garden in the story as well.
Right. Which, if people know the original tale, that's not too much of a spoiler. There's a couple of,
right,
of garden and flower places.
Yeah.
So, I thought that was really interesting. And I thought, so Ira is a very like warm and living and alive character.
Mm-hmm.
So she's a very beautiful contrast to the cold, dead, rational atmosphere, ethos that the Snow Queen just embodies. That image of perfection, that image of death. She is warm and alive. She's loving. But I found that in part of the story, it's as almost as if, like, because she's separated from Isa at that point, it's like they both, because they're not together and it's unhealthy for them to be separated, they both start going to their opposite extremes. So like, you know, she's like sleeping in the garden and covered in dirt and planting things. And I kind of, it's almost as if she's going to her unhealthy extreme because he's not there to balance her, and vice versa. Even though he's not a cold character, but they're friends. They help each other. So I wanted, like, if you could talk a little bit about that and Ira as a character, how you shaped her.
Yeah, Ira, I kind of had this concept in my mind that she feels like there are elements of Cinderella that make their way into the story as well, which for me is always a little bit inevitable, because Cinderella was my favorite growing up as a child. So, you know, she feels a little bit like an outsider in Ravinia, because she is the product of her father's first marriage, and she's biracial as well. Her father married a foreigner, and her father was an ambassador, much like Cinderella. Her father he wasn't a merchant, but he was an ambassador. He married someone from the south, and then, well, brought her mother up to Ravinia, which is a very Nordic country. And then her mother died when she was just an infant. She never knew her mother. And then her father married this other woman who's very cold and very cruel. And her stepmother is in many ways kind of a mirror of the Snow Queen herself. You know, and I wondered if readers would wonder if her mother was the Snow Queen, you know, kind of like almost like a stand-in for the Snow Queen. But I didn't lean into that too much. But it's all kind of meant to indicate that, and it's not too much of a spoiler to say either, that Ira's own father ends up, she has this wonderful relationship with her father, but then her own father ends up being cursed by the bitter glass too. And it almost immediately isolates her from her loving father. And so the only person Ira has in the entire world is Isbrand, who she loves more than anyone. But I also wanted to, and I was being a little bit, I kind of thought, is this too complex? But I kind of wanted to show this in my character development, is that Ira and Issa are a little bit too, I'll use the word obsessed. They're a little too obsessed with each other. Like they love each other. There's good love, of course, and there's the good sort of friendship love that people have, and love is good. But like both of them say things to each other in the first half of the book, really the first third of the book, because it, I don't want to say too much to spoil things that happen, but really the first third of the book, where it's like, due to Ira's isolation from everybody and her feeling so alone and her feeling out of step with even just the rest of, you know, the culture, and, you know, owing to certain circumstances that happen that make Isbrand her whole world, and due to things that happen to Isbrand and just all the circumstances, and then the fact that they go from being best friends to being very much in love with each other, that they are just completely wrapped up in each other. And the things that end up driving them away from each other, although it's bad and tragic things, for Ira in particular, it actually helps her to discover who she is aside from her relationship with Issa, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have to have individual agency as people, independent of the people that also make us whole, if that makes sense. And
it does, yeah.
You know, I was kind of digging deep back to my teenage years, you know, because my, you know, at Owl's Nest, our mission is to write these books that capture the adolescent imagination, to make sure that they are authentic to what teenagers go through, think, believe, feel, all those big emotions. And I was one of those teenagers who, like, when I liked a boy, it was like my whole personality. Mm-hmm. Like I would get so wrapped up in, you know, my crushes, my first loves, stuff like that, that it was really, when I would go through breakups, it was like devastating. My whole world fell apart. You know, I fell into some really severe depressions and things like that. There was a boy who broke up with me and I stopped eating for a week. Like it, I just remember those really big feelings. And I remember that, you know, being young, you can, like, those feelings are no less real than when you're an adult, but you're, you know, when you're a teenager, when you're an adolescent, you often don't know how to handle them or deal with them. And so your loves, your emotions, everything is much bigger in a, but you don't have as much capacity, emotional intelligence to manage those things. And so I really wanted Ira to go through this as part of her coming of age, as part of her Bildungsroman journey. That's probably redundant to say Bildungsroman journey, but, you know, as part of her
coming
of age. It helps,
in case people don't know the term. Yeah.
Yeah. To have to have the separation and have to, and that's part of her, in the second half of the book, she's traveling with James, who is a character from Son of the Deep, mm-hmm. and to build a relationship with another boy, a friendship, a healthy friendship, and to also have to figure out what she can do on her own.
Yeah, I know, it's so cool. And I love that how a quest really draws out the heart and just challenges people to become something that they've never become before. Because, you know, Ira is small. She is small of stature. And I know, you know, when you're smaller in stature than the people around you, it, like, you feel limited, and because you are, because you can't reach for things. And it's a very real thing. But for her to be courageous enough to say, like, I am going to go do this, and then to have a helper like James, it's just so fun. That friendship between them was just so fun. And the things that they learn on that journey, the people, creatures, entities they encounter, who teach them different things about the fairy world as well, and the greatness of the world. But yeah, I love how, because you were very subtle about this, which is nice. There's you know, there's a time to be clear, there's a time to be subtle, but mm-hmm. the intensity of emotion kind of counterposed to the coldness and deadness. Again, the Snow Queen, that's her whole thing. But mm-hmm. that both can be unhealthy.
Yeah.
But that love is like gardening.
Yeah.
And that it is encouraging healthy things and pruning back unhealthy things.
But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to ask you more about Ira and James' journey. So that part of the story in the original fairy tale can feel kind of, it felt a bit meandering. It was like, consecration, like, what are you doing here? Like, it felt like I was all prepped for her to go confront the Snow Queen. And then there are all these pieces in front, but you made them work in the story. So tell me about how you did that.
Yeah. So in the original fairy tale, you have, you know, this girl who's, she goes on this journey and then she encounters all these bizarre things, this witch in her garden, and she's talking to flowers for like pages. And there's a crow that comes along and helps her, and
a raven.
Well, is it a crow or a raven in the original? Because I use a raven. It is a raven in the original. Maybe it's a raven.
I need to check again, actually, because that's it. They look very similar, but different. Yeah,
anyway, I made it a raven for obvious reasons.
Black bird.
Yeah, yes. Big black bird. And then she meets this like prince and princess, and this robber girl who like ties her up and sits on her, and this band of robbers, and this Lapland woman and stuff like that. And what I did basically is I thought, okay, all of these events are weird, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to take them and I'm going to make them all kind of like, not all of them fae encounters, but I thought I'm going to say basically that many of them are fae encounters to kind of explain the weirdness, because I wanted to hang on to the weirdness of them. And in a way, it made the writing of the second half of the book very easy, because, you know, I didn't have to come up. I didn't have to invent things for them to run into. It was like, okay, I've got my events. You know, here are the things they're going to move from this to this to this to this. And then I just kind of pared down, you know, okay, so they're not going to, you know, talk to flowers in this witch's garden for pages, but let's take the essence, you know, what's the essence of this here that I can work into the novelization. And having her travel with James was practical, but it was also something that I needed, because, you know, the third book is going to be about James. And so he needed to be in this book to tie him in. But James is a great sort of, you know, Iris, if you think of it as like a comedy duo, you know, James is kind of the funny man to Iris' straight man, right? Mm-hmm. So, because Ira was always going to be very serious, because she's off on a quest to save, you know, the boy she loves. That's a very serious thing. But also, nobody wants to read about, you know, just stay stuck in her head with nobody for her to talk to for half of the book. So she's got to have a companion. So it was just a matter of, okay, who's going to be her companion? Well, James will be her companion, which was always my intention, though, was that he was going to come and travel with her. And James is hilarious. Mm-hmm. So it worked really well. And that the second half of the book was very, very easy to build. It came together very fast. I had a lot of fun just playing around with the weirdness of it.
Well, one thing, again, not trying to spoil, but I think keeping it vague might be okay. But the people that they encounter, it continues the theme of like, what does it mean to love?
Yeah.
And what does it mean to love in the right way? What does it mean to take care of someone? What does it mean to be generous? So, yeah, there's a group of people who have a warped idea of generosity and benevolence. But yeah, that continuation of like the connection between seeing and living and loving. Which is continued from the Hobgoblin's mirror, because the mirror distorts that capability
in
people. It's just so fun. But yeah, a quest is nice. Like, I feel for anyone who's writing a fairy tale retelling, like a quest is just a nice structure in which to insert whatever you want to insert. But it gives you things to talk about. It continues the narrative. You know, just gives you a straight line to work with.
It's a good way to continuously raise the stakes, raise the tension in the story, to move from point to point, and in meaningful ways too, because you don't want to, you know, as a writer, you don't want to just raise the stakes in ways that don't have any ultimate, you know, like they don't really matter ultimately to the story as a whole. But
right, it would feel like a waste of time.
It's just a waste of time. Like, you don't want to have chapters that the reader could skip and they wouldn't, it wouldn't matter, you know?
Right.
So the quest that Ira and James go on each, everything that they go through has some element of character development for them. Mm-hmm. And it's ultimately really important for James as well, because of the development that he needs to go through in preparation for his own standalone book. You know, I say these books are all standalones, and they are. You know, each of them mm-hmm. Can be read individually. You don't have to read the other books in the series in order to understand what's going on in each of them. But if you read them all, it's much more edifying, because you understand I would say, especially for James, because of the development that he goes through in each book. But you know, their journey was also really important for me because of that friendship and love element that it just, you know, some of the best relationships I've ever had in my life have been friendships with boys, with men that are mm-hmm. not romantic in any way. And I think that we're told often that you can't do that, especially once you are married, that you can only have friendships with other women and men can only have friendships with other men. But as much as, you know, you need to be kind of careful about where you're spending your time and whatnot, mm-hmm. There are all sorts of love in this world, and we're designed to be able to have wonderful relationships with people. And friendship is a very important aspect of life.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you had that in Son of the Deep too. I really appreciated that because The Little Mermaid can be a little bit like, it's all about you. It's all about what you want, or it's all about your romance. But instead, they're just surrounded by all these loving characters, this beautiful community.
Yeah.
See, I really appreciated that aspect mm-hmm. in Son of the Deep as well. So it also occurred to me how James gets to witness Ira's love and how she loves. And that really changes him, that seeing something good in another person that makes you want to echo that. That's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's important for James and will continue to be important. I'm about halfway through writing the sequel to this book, and that it continues to be important for him as he sets off on his own journey.
I wanted to ask about, just to circle back a little bit to the crow Raven, who is a raven in your book, because especially on my second read, I began to really notice that. It's like the country is called Ravinia, if I'm saying that right. And, you know, Isa is the raven prince, the raven king, and that becomes important later. And also bears. Like there's a lot of, you know, bearskin clothing and bears later in the story. So can you tell me about those aspects? You said you like animal symbolism. And also, did you research like Nordic countries? You mentioned, the woman who shows up later, he's a Lapland woman. But mm-hmm. What kind of research did you do? And how did you weave that lore into your story?
So the raven idea, you know, I had called, just that kind of just goes back to Son of the Deep. I had called the kingdom across the sea Ravinia. And so there wasn't, when I went to use the Snow Queen as the basis for the next story, I thought I would lean into this idea that ravens were really important. That was kind of a just sort of happy sort of, oh, okay, I already called it Ravinia. You know, like mm-hmm. ravens are going to be sort of their most important animal and symbol. And basically, I didn't do a lot of research. I'm going to just confess that, as far as, you know, looking into Nordic cultures and things like that. But I did just kind of do the whole, okay, what makes the most logical sense here? You know, it's a cold country. They're going to use a lot of, you know, it's going to be reindeers. There's going to be bear. There's mm-hmm. going to be ravens. As far as the raven's name is Munin, and that comes from and now I will be the one mispronouncing things. Hugin and Munin, I'm not sure. But those were Odin's ravens in Norse mythology. And
memory,
yeah,
right?
Memory. So Munin means memory. And that was intentional. So when Munin shows up, because, and I don't want to spoil things, but when he shows mm-hmm. up and what it all kind of means, and if you look at how he interacts, it's important to what has been going on with Isbrand. And so him interacting in his name, meaning memory, is important in the story. I will say that. But it was also important to me that there be a raven in the story because of the, you know, original fairy tale and there being a crow raven companion in the story. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. Yeah, no, that clicks. That makes a lot of sense. And it's just so fun because it's a symbolism that goes underneath that not every reader will notice. I didn't really connect union with Odin's raven, but
yeah,
it works. Yeah, it creates those rich layers. I feel like working in the fairy tale and folklore tradition, you're drawing on deep wells, and you're doing so probably a lot without realizing it. If you've fed yourself on good stories, there are just deep images and motifs and symbolism that you may not even know what you're playing with, but something feels right.
Yeah, and that's exactly, you know, like feeding yourself on good stories, that's exactly right. A lot of this stuff just kind of simmers beneath the surface. And so when you turn around and read, because when you turn around and read something like what I've written here, then you would go, sometimes it's just a matter of it feels familiar and you don't know why it feels familiar, but that familiarity makes you like the story. Like I always said, some of these stories, you know, sometimes I read a book and I go, I just liked that. And I'm not entirely sure why, although these days I'm usually able to identify why, just because I'm a close reader and I taught classical history for 10 years and, you know, and I grew up reading Edith Hamilton's mythology, you know, I practically haven't memorized, you know, these days it's hard to kind of slip one by me. But you know, when I was younger, it was a lot of like, that was really good. And I don't know why it was just really good. And I kind of assume that my young readers who are target audience, of course, probably aren't able to identify why they might love, you know, why they might read my books and love them, but that they will have that sort of tug that it just resonates with them a certain way over something else that they might pick up that isn't written with these intentional things that have been put into it, because I am very intentional in my writing. You know, all of my writing, all of my storytelling, it harkens back to all of my influences, all of the depth of things that I read and have read my whole life, you know, it's when the author writes with intention, you know, whether it's me or someone else, then that makes its way into the story. And it is this sort of subliminal, I don't want to say messaging because I don't like fiction. I don't think fiction should be message first by any stretch. You know, the story has to come first. But it is a sort of subliminal sort of beauty that runs underneath. That's the goal, at least. You know, I hate to say, I don't want to be one of those authors who's like, well, when you read my books, you will find it beautiful. Well, I hope you do. I hope you do. I'm not, you know, I don't want to be arrogant and say that, but there are authors who write that way, and then there are authors who don't. But being a deep reader, I try to write that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you know what beauty is, which I mean, that's a whole big conversation, yeah. But and goodness is and truth is, if you can look at the world. So again, part of the fun of a fairy tale is that such big, powerful symbols like sun and moon and snow and wells and dragons, you know, it's like playing a piano and trusting the keys to give beautiful sound. So,
yeah, I always say that writing a novel should be actually very much like writing music. I used to say that. I used to teach creative writing. I taught creative writing for years. And I used to tell people, this is why you should be intentional in writing a novel. It's not just sitting down and vomiting words onto the page. One of the biggest arguments for intentionally writing and intentionally crafting an outline, intentionally having story structure, and intentionally, you know, putting the symbolism and all that sort of thing is because it is very much like writing a piece of music. Music sounds beautiful to our ears, because there is logic to how music is supposed to go together, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. If the chords are dissonant, they sound ugly to us. And a novel is very much the same way. And you know, it's scientific, it's mathematical. There's no way around that. Like, there's no one on earth who's going to listen to a piece of dissonant, to a dissonant chord, is going to hear that and go, that sounds great, you know? And novels, story is very much the same way. You do have to tell it a certain way. There is beauty. And I'm not saying there's only one way, though. There are, you know, multitudinous ways to tell a story. But if it's illogical in the structure, if it's not told well, then it's not going to sound beautiful. So what is under the surface in the planning of it is important, so that it rings beautiful to the ears and so that it doesn't ring dissonant to the reader.
Well, I love that analogy. I love just looking at even mathematics to thinking of the Snow Queen itself.
Yeah.
I had this conversation a little bit in the other episode I did on the Snow Queen, but Hans Christian Andersen's treatment of math in this story, it kind of stands for like cold, rationally logic. But math is the secret language of the universe.
Yeah.
It's musical. It's beautiful. Like it's a testament to the faithfulness of God that he made this world that, you know, makes sense and does have like rules and laws. Sounds bad, except that means we can, you know, the sun rises every day. It's this beautiful story and it's this piece of music. So
yeah,
a story that kind of has those good bones to it and that fits together, which, you know, I believe that the gospel story is the underlying music, which, you know, the like death and resurrection and forgiveness and creation, those big ideas are what make a beautiful story if you tell them right.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to ask you, because you've taught creative writers, and what are some things you discovered between Son of the Deep and Son of Bitter Glass? Was there anything that surprised you in this particular genre?
I mean, I would just say that I was surprised at how rich the fairy tales were when I really got into them, like the original source material. It's not that I was unfamiliar with fairy tales, but you always hear from people, I think it's common to hear from people, let me just put it that way, that, oh, well, if you look at original fairy tales, they're so dark. They're so twisted. Maybe you've heard that before. And I just think, wow, these people are totally misunderstanding fairy tales. You know, that's one of those things that makes me kind of scratch my head and wonder, can people really, do they understand what they're reading? Like, can people read? Because I look at, you sit down and you read, you know, to refer back to Cinderella, you know, some of these versions of Cinderella, oh, you know, people kind of get hung up on the fact that in, you know, one of the versions of Cinderella, she has to cut off her heel to fit it into the slipper. And that's kind of used as, you know, evidence that real fairy tales are gruesome and terrible and terrifying. It's like, no, you know.
Also, I think that was your stepsister.
Yeah.
Or stepsister.
Something like that. And it's like, that's not actually, you know, just because there's this gruesome part in it doesn't actually mean that the fairy tale itself is gruesome and horrible and terrifying. Actually, the original Cinderellas, any of them, they contain beautiful imagery and symbolism. You know, the fairy godmother is representative of the Holy Spirit. There's redemption, and then for Jesus. Like, you have these, the fairy tales are incredibly rich. Not all of them. Some of them are, I mean, there's thousands of them out there, but some of them are pretty weak. But like, or the original Little Mermaid, I was always told, oh, it's so dark, you know, oh, she kills herself at the end, you know, stuff like that. But if you do a close reading of The Little Mermaid, there's the fact that the Little Mermaid dies at the end of Hans Christian Andersen's story is like, it's a total misunderstanding and misreading of what he's saying. Like, she goes up to heaven, essentially. Like, her whole purpose in the original fairy tale is not actually to marry the prince. Like, the whole purpose is to have this redemption. Like, her whole life she spends longing to go up, like looking up. This is why I say it's very much like Cupid and Psyche, is this sort of, you know, looking up, longing for this sort of mountaintop to be redeemed, to escape from the valley of, you know, being shackled to the ocean. She actually achieves exactly what she was hoping for in more ways than being married to the prince would have fulfilled it for her. She achieves a spiritual redemption at the end of the story. Not in the way necessarily that readers want it to happen, but in a way that's better. So I was really surprised at, yeah, just kind of the layers and the depths. And even with the Snow Queen too, it's this whole idea, you think you're going to get this showdown with the queen at the end of the story, and you don't get that. You know, I'm talking about the original fairy tale. Mm-hmm. You get this, you know, this scene where little Kay, who is the boy in the original story, is trying to spell out eternity, and the queen is nowhere to be found. And so that really got me thinking too, when I was evaluating the original story, is how was I going to work that into the version that I was telling? You know, which needs a little bit more than just, okay, you know, Gerda gets there and takes him.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, you want a climax and some more drama in there.
You know,
yeah,
but this idea that the Snow Queen is longing for a way to be eternal. So that was something that I worked into Son of Bitter Glass. But there are just layers. Well, and that idea too, you know, as much as Hans Christian Andersen is kind of weird and harsh on math, what was he, you know, I kept asking these questions, what was he really getting at with this fixation on math and the Snow Queen's, you know, how she makes everything in its place. Everything has to be, in her mind, perfect. But she's searching for eternity, and she's trying to make eternity essentially on Earth. And the subversion of that by these two little humans that come along. And so that was an idea, you know, that exists in the original fairy tale that then I was able to take and expand. And so that wasn't something that I just invented out of thin air. It was in the original fairy tale. So a long way to just answer your question is I just have found, and I have really been pleasantly surprised at how rich the source material is and how much it gives me to play with and expand.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And just on the last thing you said, you compared the Snow Queen's palace to a tomb, mm-hmm. which is just the perfect encapsulation of what it does when you try to create eternity on Earth and perfection on Earth. Well, you know, you create this image of death. Yeah, we can't do that. So I love that. I've been doing this podcast has given me a similar pleasure. And just there's so much to work with. And it is fun to interact with the people of the past this way. How many storytellers had their hands on these fairy tales? So Karen, is there anything else you wanted to talk about in the time we had left?
I mean, I think we've about covered it. I would just say, for those people who are close readers, pay attention to the ways in which the glass house kind of mirrors the end of the story as well. I like to, I always write kind of there and back again stories, even if it's not a there and back again quest. Although in this case, it actually is. But yeah, there's lots of glass motifs, lots of mirror motifs, and repetition of language and things like that. So it was in many ways just a fun story to lean into lots of that sort of stuff. So yeah, I just kind of look forward to the feedback on the story overall. Yeah.
Yes, definitely. Yes. So the best place to order a copy would be probably just straight through the Owl's Nest website.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you can get a signed copy if you order at owlsnest.com. But it is available wherever books are sold. And so wherever you prefer, whether that's requesting through your local bookstore, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, of course, is always an option. Or you can get it on Kindle.
Yes, sounds good. Yes, I did. So Karen, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was really fun to hear from you.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, this was a great conversation.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review so others can find it too.